Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. Jefferson's Heart and Vascular Program treats a range of cardiovascular disease with a combination of personalized care and advanced therapies. Jefferson cardiologists specialize in treating the most complex cases and are experienced in non-surgical approaches, helping more patients avoid open heart surgery. For more information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jefferson.edu. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, 1-800-JEFF-NOW.
The Environmental Protection Agency says fracking can have an impact on drinking water, but it's a rare occurrence. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. First up on this evening's show, EPA's long-awaited report on hydraulic fracturing offers no specific policy recommendations. Joining us to distill the findings is State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips.
Well, Congress asked the EPA to look into this back in 2010. So it is a very long-awaited study. And at the beginning, the sense was, okay, the EPA would finally answer these questions that all of us have about fracking. Does it pollute water? How does it pollute water? And the main finding of this study is that it can impact water, but, and this is the word they like to use, it is not widespread. One thing that's important for folks to remember, Dave, is that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has confirmed 256 cases where gas drilling, both conventional and unconventional gas drilling in Pennsylvania, has impacted water, private water supplies, and that's since 2008.
So what are the limitations then of the study?
Well, one of the things that the EPA science advisor, Thomas Burke, told reporters today on a conference call was that this study is not meant to be a health assessment of the impacts of fracking. And what it did was look at what they called the hydraulic cycle, or the use of water from the beginning to the end. And that's from taking it out of the river, trucking it to the frack site, mixing it with chemicals, shooting it down a well under very high pressure to, of course, break up the shale and release the gas, taking the water that comes back up the well to the treatment center, treating it, recycling it, or disposing of it. And so it did find that there were parts of that process where water contamination could occur. Things like spills of the wastewater or not treating the wastewater properly. So they're saying that all those things could happen. They're just saying that it's not widespread.
So for those interested in a more definitive health assessment of the risks of fracturing, what happens next?
One of the things that the EPA science advisor Thomas Burke said to reporters was, quote, "This is not a question of safe or unsafe. It's a question of understanding our vulnerabilities." So I think it stopped short of answering a lot of questions for people. And what's interesting is as soon as this was released, my inbox started filling up with, you know, press releases from both environmentalists and the industry. And what's funny, Dave, is they both hail the report as confirmation of their point of view. And so, in other words, the environmentalists are saying, see, this report confirms what we've always said, fracking does pollute water. On the other hand, industry is saying, see, this is what we've always said, fracking is safe. So it's really how you read the study. But what's interesting is that the EPA really refuses to come out and say whether it's safe or not.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Susan Phillips, State Impact Pennsylvania on NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter's plan to raise $105 million for the city schools by boosting property taxes nearly 10% has hit a brick wall in city council. So much of the spring has been spent looking for an alternative to fill the school district's budget hole. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that compromise is coming together, though it's not final.
City Councilwoman Janie Blackwell is a big supporter of education, but says she can't stomach the $105 million property tax hike.
I've been against real estate. I'm always against real estate. I hate a real estate tax.
Among other things, the compromise calls for raising about $50 million from real estate taxes and increasing the use and occupancy tax about $10 million. Joe Grace of the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce says even though the group supports the schools, the tax was increased just 3 years ago.
It does send a signal to businesses that can move. Here we go, raising that same tax again.
Another option is increasing the parking tax, says Councilman Bill Greenlee, who introduced the proposal and quoted a legendary city councilwoman while doing so.
Ideally, we would like to not raise taxes and have the school district have more money. In the inimitable words of Gussie Clark, we're politicians, not magicians, so we have to figure out some way to find what we'd like to think is a middle ground here.
Council Majority Leader Curtis Jones says even using all these options, the package still doesn't add up to the $105 million the school district requested.
Members have come to consensus that we should at least do the $80 to $84 million worth of deficit.
A spokesman for Mayor Nutter says he hopes that as City Council continues its deliberations and reviews all the options, members will eventually come to the conclusion that his proposed real estate tax hike is the only way to go. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The investigation into the Amtrak 188 fatal train derailment in Philadelphia last month is focusing on whether the engineer was using his cell phone when the train approached a curve at more than twice the speed limit. National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Christopher Hart told congressional committee members this week that even he was surprised by the difficulty in making that determination. Let's put that problem to University of Southern California engineering professor Bhaskar Krishnamachari. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, on the face of it, it seems rather simple. My phone, like I'm sure all phones now, come with a timestamp. Isn't it just a matter of lining up that stated time with the time of the crash?
I guess the real question is, what is it that's being timestamped? So if somebody's using the phone for, let's say, sending text messages, you might have timestamps on your phone that indicate exactly when you sent it out or when you received a phone message. But if you're, for example, on the phone browsing an earlier message, there's not going to be necessarily a timestamp generated because of that. Or if you're doing other things on your phone, such as maybe browsing a website that you had already loaded earlier and you're just, looking at it. So not everything you do on a phone necessarily will generate a timestamp.
Well, then, does that ambiguity mean that there will never be a conclusive answer in this regard?
I guess you can have positive answers, right? So if you do have a timestamp, when that particular message was received or sent. But if there isn't a timestamp that's directly pointing to activity at that time window of interest, then yeah, I guess it is ambiguous.
Going forward, a relatively low-tech solution is being offered, that merely being having Amtrak trains equipped with inward-facing video cameras. Would that solve this problem?
Absolutely. I mean, if you have any way of directly monitoring what an individual is doing while they're driving a vehicle, certainly that should lower the ambiguity associated with what they were doing and when they were doing it. I was going to just add that, for example, for certain other activities such as web browsing or other applications that are not just texting or messaging or phone calls, there could also be records which could be a little bit harder to locate as to whether there were files in the mobile device's operating system that were modified. So there could be timestamps associated with that as well. But these typically take a lot longer to determine because it's perhaps not as straightforward as determining the timestamps of messages and calls.
But in saying could be, does that raise some ambiguity about whether they are necessarily recorded?
You know, the thing is that depending on what the activity is, it may not be recorded. And some kinds of activities, such as, for example, downloading a file from a browser, initiating the launching of a browser and accessing a website, some of that data download could be recorded. But one source of ambiguity is that there are many applications which download data in the background without the user asking for that to be downloaded at that moment. So, for example, you may have a podcast that is just updating itself in the background. It's downloading other episodes. But it's not doing that because the user is actively downloading them, but rather the application has a timer set that's doing that automatically. And so disambiguating whether the user did it or whether there's an application that's pulling files in the background can be challenging.
Interesting. No wonder the head of the National Transportation Safety Board says that he, too, was surprised by the difficulty in making the determination. There seems to be more than meets the mind, at the simplest sense.
Right. I think the main reason why it's challenging is that, you know, 10 years ago, the main thing we did with our phones was make phone calls and perhaps a little bit of SMS texting. But these days, the ways in which we use our mobile devices have changed dramatically. And also the applications that run on our mobile devices in many cases are using and accessing the network without our awareness.
Professor, thanks for joining us to shed light on this situation.
Thank you.
University of Southern California engineering professor Bhaskar Krishnamachari. Turning to this evening's headlines, newly announced fare changes by PATCO will affect thousands of commuters who use the high-speed line connecting New Jersey and Philadelphia. PATCO says its electronic Freedom Card will be compatible with SEPTA's new key fare system once it's operational later this year. Delaware residents are arriving at the state capitol in Dover, paying last respects to former Attorney General Beau Biden. The eldest son of Vice President Joe Biden died of brain cancer Saturday at the age of 46. Governor Jack Markell and former Governor Ruth Ann Minner were among those gathered today. 64 degrees, cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. There's a 40% chance of showers overnight, low 58 degrees. Remaining cloudy tomorrow, Friday's high 72. And then some breaks of sunshine amid the clouds on Saturday, high 82 degrees. Still ahead.
We need to save people who are hungry and needy and take care of people that are in real need, not save a newspaper.
Editors at the Jewish Exponent get their pink slips. What's next for the paper? That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf with the Oscar award-winning claymation film. After nearly 80 years, it still enchants adults and children alike. Also on the program, Saint-Saëns' The Carnival of the Animals with Curtis's duo pianist, the Naughton Twins. Tickets at 215-893-1999 and online. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Peter and the Wolf with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Did you learn something interesting today on WHYY? I'm Jennifer Lynn, and I learn every day as host of Morning Edition. Since you do too, please make a donation to WHYY in support of high-quality programming. Now is a great time to make a gift. If we can receive 5,000 donations by Monday, June 15th, an anonymous donor will give WHYY an additional $25,000. Visit WHYY.org to make your donation. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Okay, students, put down your number two pencils. Standardized tests are over for the school year in Philadelphia. However, the impact of kids not taking those statewide tests or opting out are just starting to be understood. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has the story of the numbers in Philadelphia.
Dear Wagner parents, my daughter is an eighth grader at Wagner Middle School.
Tonya Ba is reading a letter she shared with parents at her daughter's school in West Oak Lane.
We will not accept the label of failure for our students, our teachers, or our schools.
Her letter convinced 171 parents at Wagner to commit a kind of scholastic civil disobedience by sitting their kids out of standardized tests.
So what can be done? Refuse the tests, opt out, refuse standardized testing on grounds that can't be disputed.
Opting out is a way of legally refusing some tests. Opt out is also the name of a movement led by parents and advocates to push back against testing they say eats up instruction time and in some cases psychologically harms students. Thanks to their organizing efforts, this year nearly 600 Philadelphia students opted out of the PSSAs, Pennsylvania Standardized Test for elementary and middle grades. That's a big leap up, says the school district's Chris Schaefer.
We had approximately 20 opt-outs last year.
He says another 186 opted out of the Keystone exams this year. Starting in 2017, that suite of tests will determine which students get a high school diploma. Ba says she hopes the opt-outs will get authorities to rethink standardized testing.
The message to the state is not only should you waive the Keystone exam as a requirement for a high school diploma, but you should do away with it altogether.
Some in Harrisburg are considering changing the graduation requirement, but the wheels of legislative change turn slowly and sometimes not at all. In the meantime, test scores are still used to record progress, says Matt Stem, deputy secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Education.
The state's position is that the exams are an indicator of student growth. They're a snapshot in time that allow us to appropriately support schools.
Test scores and participation are also tied to money. Stem says they're a part of how the federal government rates schools that get Title I funding. That money goes to schools with a high number of students in poverty. In the national conversation about opting out, states with lots of kids refusing tests were threatened they could lose federal funding. But for an individual school with lots of opt-outs, the outcome could be the exact opposite. If enough students at a Title I school don't take a test, then they can be put in a higher need category.
Opting out in that way could mean more resources and attention for a school.
That's correct. That could be the case.
But the Philadelphia schools with the most opt-outs are already high need, so they won't see any more of that money. Another possible impact, at the state level, test scores go into a kind of report card called a school performance profile. Rather than drag down a school's test average, Schaefer says school opt-outs won't be a factor in the profiles at all.
So if I had 100 students in third grade and 50 opted out, then the denominator wouldn't be 100, it would be 50.
In essence, those students aren't counted. But who are they? Many of the students opting out in large numbers are English language learners or special education students, groups that tend to perform below average on standardized tests. Not counting those students has the potential to skew test results. Opt-out advocate Tiffany Lorch teaches English language learners and says her students can't pass the tests anyway.
It's not a realistic expectation. It doesn't even show growth.
Still, the number of Philadelphia opt-outs is relatively small for such a large school district. In Lower Marion School District, 272 students opted out of PSSAs, and it's 1/20th the size of Philadelphia. Ba says if the state doesn't change its focus on testing, parents like her will keep taking matters into their own hands. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
The Jewish Exponent has been publishing its weekly paper in the Philadelphia area since the 1880s. Now, going through one of its biggest shakeups ever, the paper has laid off its entire editorial staff and plans to outsource its management to a Baltimore company. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, officials at the Exponent say readers won't even notice the change, though some community observers are skeptical.
The Exponent's Steve Rosenberg wrote what he called a special announcement to readers. Down in the 10th paragraph, Rosenberg noted that all 15 staffers who work in production and editorial will be canned. The Baltimore company Mid-Atlantic Media, which runs other Jewish publications, will take the management reins and be in charge of hiring new staff in Philly.
If you keep getting punched in the face when you walk down the street, you know, walk down a different street.
And they were costly punches, operating at a loss of $300,000 a year. Rosenberg says the nonprofit connected to the Jewish Exponent was filling in the hole left by fleeing readers and vanishing ad dollars.
That can't happen. We're using donor dollars here. Like, we need to save people who are hungry and needy and take care of people that are in real need, not save a newspaper.
Jane Eisner is the editor of The Forward, a national publication covering Jewish issues. She says the change could weaken the connection 24,000 remaining local subscribers have to the paper. She says it will be hard to replace the institutional knowledge about the community that the old staff had.
Media binds a community together, and I think that there is something lost when those things are under threat. And I think we're just going to have to all work harder to figure out how to make it sustainable.
Yet Rosenberg says cutting staff was the only option to keep the paper alive.
Maybe I was the only guy that had the chutzpah, so to speak, to sit there and actually do it. You know, it's not an easy thing to do to lay people off.
Though the paper will now be produced in Baltimore, they plan to hire local reporters to write stories. Rosenberg says leaner staff should help them do something they haven't done in years, break even. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Dozens of murals adorn the sides of buildings throughout Philadelphia, and today, the program behind those colorful creations unveiled a new project to bring more public art to the city. NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas reports.
After decades of brightening Philadelphia with wall murals, the city's mural arts program is going 3D. From now through October, its open source project will install sculptures in temporary public locations throughout the city. Jane Golden, executive director of the mural arts program, unveiled the first installation in Paines Park along the Schuylkill River. She sees the sculpture project as a natural progression of their work.
I think what we've been doing over the last 5-6 years is really exploring muralism in the 21st century and all that means. And I think we have an obligation to our program, to the city, and to the field to keep pushing it as far as we can. So some of our projects now are more conceptual, some are installations, some are sculptural, like the one we're dedicating today.
Open Source's curator, Pedro Alonso, says the heart of the project is its interactivity. The two works installed in Paines Park, Steps and Pyramid, by British artist Jonathan Monk, are skatable. Skateboarder Brandon John tried them.
They're a little different, and part of an obstacle that's fun to skate is that it's not exactly made for skateboarding, so that's kind of cool about it.
Golden says the project adds to the ways people can engage with art.
I like to think that people can interact with our work. Sometimes it's during the conceptual or design phase. Sometimes it's during, and people participate in the art-making process. And so I just love the fact that Jonathan Monk wanted to do skatable sculpture.
13 more sculptures will be installed all around the city. The sites include government buildings, playgrounds, schools, and commercial corridors. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Finally this evening, this is for all you Harry Potter fans. The series may be over, but your fantasies can live on in art. More than 300 attendees are expected at tomorrow's opening reception of a Harry Potter group art show in South Philly. Created by friends Catherine Egan and Annabelle Buck, the event was initially intended to be small and casual. Buck said she had no idea how into it people would be before she sent a call to artists on Facebook.
It's sort of dorky and like, so, like, in my mind, it wasn't super serious, but then, like, some of the pieces that people turned in were, like, really well thought out, really well done.
Some of the pieces they have are most excited about include a carved wand and a Death Eater mask. And with art being submitted from across the country, Egan says she's not surprised so many people still love Harry Potter.
I think my goal is just to be like, hey, guys, I love Harry Potter. You love Harry Potter? Cool. Let's continue to love Harry Potter.
40 to 50 artists have entered pieces into the show opening tomorrow night at Milk and Honey Cafe. Themed refreshments are also provided, ranging from an infused polyjuice potion to chocolate frogs. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Delaware Valley University supports WHYY. With DelVal's Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology, students develop the skills, knowledge, and clinical experience needed to work in the lives of others. Graduates are prepared to apply for the Pennsylvania Licensed Professional Counselor credential. A specialization in social justice or child and adolescent counseling can help make a difference in the community. More about a Delaware Valley University Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology is online at delval.edu/grad.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Foundation offers charitable gift annuities, charitable remainder trusts, and pooled income funds. Talk to your financial advisor about how these income-generating and tax-saving tools can build resources for community organizations. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org. 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.